told Dr. Smith that I was not unhappy at all about the informal atmosphere of you eating your lunches and so forth, but I do have one personal request, and that's that nobody sit right in front of me eating dill pickles. Our topic for this afternoon's lecture in apologetics is entitled In Search of God. And it deals with the question of religious plurality, which is certainly one of the thorniest problems in the subject matter of Christian apologetics. The first thing which we notice about the religious scene in general is just that there is far from universal agreement among all men as to who, what, when, where, and how God is. There are numerous religions of the world, all giving a different portrayal of the God whom they worship. With all the different points of view, how are we to come to any genuine knowledge of God? This is a question that the scientist of religion must ask. What can we say about all this diversity, this contradiction, this multiformity and disagreement in theological outlook? Now, one kind of reply to the religious plurality and multiplicity found in the world is a statement from Book 4 of the Quran, where we read, quote, "Fight for the religion of God. Fight for the religion of God." Now, while few religions may agree with the Quran that the religion of God is to be spread with sword and bloody warfare, still the idea that there is a religion of God that can be distinguished from the different religious opinions of the world, and one which is worthy of fighting for, has been a common answer given to the religious plurality of the world, especially in the history of mankind. However, a contrary and a much more recent answer is also being put forward. And that answer is being found both in West and in East. In the East, it's typified by the parable of Mount Fuji from Japan, where the parable tells us that there are many and different roads on the mountain, but they all take one to the top of the mountain. Even so, there are many religions in the world, but they all lead up to God. Ramakrishna, the most recent incarnation of Brahman, according to the followers of the Hindu Vedanta, lived in Bengal toward the end of last century, and he asserted, quote, "Truth is one. Sages call it by various names." And he maintained that the various religious leaders of the world were as waves to a single ocean. And the same basic answer to the diversity of conceptions about God is found in the West. If you look at Volume 2, the 1898 edition of George Bernard Shaw's Plays Pleasant and Unpleasant, he declares, quote, "There is only one religion, though there are 100 versions of it." And in Volume 3 of Robert Burton, 1621, The Anatomy of Melancholy, he says, quote, "One religion, as is true, is as true as another." So the prevailing mood of our day in the study of comparative religions and academic institutions across the land is pungently summarized in this affirmation by Sir Arthur Keith, "No creed is final." You see, all this religious diversity is nothing more than many waves to one single ocean. All the roads lead to the top, to God. It's one religion with many expressions. And surprisingly, the most acclaimed Roman Catholic theologian alive today, Bernard Lonergan, harmonizes with that approach to religious plurality, which we've been sketching here. He says in his Method in Theology, quote, "Before it enters the world mediated by meaning, religion is the prior word God speaks to us by flooding our hearts with his love. That prior word pertains not to the world mediated by meaning, but to the world of immediacy, to the unmediated experience of the mystery of love and of awe. The outwardly spoken word is historically conditioned. Its meaning depends upon the human context in which it's uttered." That is, it's the same experience of love, the same experience of awe, but given the religious and cultural situation, it comes to different mediated, meaningful expressions. And so, in essence, what we have between Ramakrishna, the Hindu, and Lonergan, the Catholic, is the view that no religion can really be wrong. Underneath the surface, once we get away from the culturally conditioned creeds that variously explain it, all religions are the same. Now, because one religion is as true as another, then, no religion is fundamentally false. You see, there's a little bit of hidden motivation to this, this broad ecclesiastical or ecumenical latitudinarian attitude among the scientists of religion. For you see, if we say that all religions are fundamentally the same, then whatever expression you give to it cannot be attacked. It cannot be said to be wrong. Because one religion is as true as another, no religion is false. There's only one fundamental religion that comes wrapped in different packages. And according to this point of view, all religions can be reduced to a lowest common denominator. For instance, it's commonly said that some vague theism plus the golden rule or the rule of love is the central tenet of all religious faiths. Perhaps I could diagram that view that I wish to attack in my lecture this afternoon by a series of concentric circles. What you have is this broad anti-naturalism, all those who stand in awe of the natural world. They don't necessarily put a name on it, but they have this feeling, this the idea of the holy, if you will. The noumena is somehow impinging on them. But then among this broad classification of religious, anti-naturalistic individuals, you have those who call it God. And then, of course, a smaller group within them are personal theists, and a smaller group within that are monotheists, and a smaller group within that would be Trinitarian theist, and then right down in the middle as a Calvinist. That's usually not taught. But that's the idea. You have these this broad... Now, you may want to focus down to this pinpoint. That's great. But realize that you have in common all these other levels or strata of experience. And I'm going to give just three reasons why I think that particular point of view has difficulties. Of course, if one rigorously analyzes it in the first place, it transgresses the most elementary law of logic, the law of non-contradiction. A is not non-A in the same sense, and at the same time, hot is not cold, white is not black, here is not there, and your car can't both be parked in the parking lot and not be parked in the parking lot at the same time right now. This law of non-contradiction is obvious to all thinking people. I had a professor of literature in college once who put it very well, I think. He said, you know, you have all these sages, all these philosophers through the ages, Plato down to the greatest, you know, and what have they come up with? A is not non-A. That summarizes philosophy for you, you know, the really profound truths. And, of course, he was being sarcastic. He said, in literature, we get into the really diverse and interesting things of life. In philosophy, it's just this barren law of non-contradiction. But my point by the illustration is that everybody recognizes it. You simply can't have contradictory statements entertained at the same time and understood. And, indeed, the law of non-contradiction is a condition of honesty, isn't it? If you don't understand the difference between this is my wallet and this is not your wallet, or this is my wallet and this is your wallet, then we'd all better keep an eye on you when you come in the room and a hand on our wallets. But notice now that the viewpoint that we're talking about violates that law of non-contradiction. For it states that a religion holding to the unity and the simplicity of God is as true as a religion holding to the plurality and complexity of God. We are being told that a religion which holds to God's creation of the world is just as true as a religion which holds that God is the world. Religions make contrary claims. But then we will be told, while details may differ from faith to faith, still underneath everything there is a common experience, usually the experience of love. However, that doesn't remove the difficulty. That just brings us to another level of the same difficulty. While we may be willing to give the formal label of love to a diversity of things, it really boggles our imagination to think that the actions of the Good Samaritan and the actions of the Aztecs in mixing their children's blood with honey and flour to appease the gods are alike expressions of love. Is there really just one religion common to all faiths when devotion calls for the starvation of thousands because the Hindus will not eat cattle, and devotion calls for feeding a stranger if you're a Christian? We can see that what is meant by love or devotion is really not the same from religion to religion, just as we can see that logically all religious creeds are not saying the same thing. But the most devastating result of holding that all religions are the same and none can be false is that it renders the whole realm of religion nonsense. Because no religion can be falsified, you see, religion as a whole can have no cognitive status in any ordinary way. Religion does not tell us anything at all because it doesn't deny anything at all. If your statement is not set in contradiction to something, if you're not delineating some determinate area of meaning by your statements, then you're not stating anything. Religion is really nothing but a hollow void, a chimera, a fantasy. It's a vain striving after wind, to put it in biblical language. If it is not conceivable, now it may not be that you can actually falsify a particular religion, but if it's not even conceivable that it could be false or in some way falsified, then there was nothing to the religion in the first place. Although it appears to be saying something, although it appears to be taking a position, although it appears to be giving guidance, it's really a non-falsifiable religion, and it evaporates. Time does not permit me to use the illustration I wish to, but secular philosopher in the area of philosophy of religion has this very interesting, of course, parable of the two gardeners, or the men who are going through the forest and come across a plot. One man calls it a garden, saying that it's tended by a gardener. The other says, of course not, it's just an accidental, you know, growth of flowers here. And the man who maintains there is this gardener says, well, no, we'll just wait, the gardener will come, and you'll see that there's a gardener. And they wait, and they camp out, and nobody comes to tend the garden. And so the naturalist says, see, there's no gardener. Absolutely proving. He goes, oh, no, you've missed the point. He's an invisible gardener. He came, we just didn't see him. So they put up barbed wire fences, and they electrify it, and they bring out the hounds and everything. And yet there's no barking, no shrieks from the fence and so forth. And eventually, the man who's claiming there's a gardener says, well, he's an invisible, intangible, eternally elusive gardener. He won't come because we're waiting for him here. And so the reply of Anthony Flew, who is giving the parable, well, actually it's a parable from John Wisdom, but Flew is the one who has popularized it, is, you see how a very fine, brash hypothesis may thus be killed by inches, the death of 1,000 qualifications. You see, and that's what we as Christians and all religious people are doing. If we say, well, now I maintain Jesus is the only way to the Father, and then when somebody comes along who is a Hindu and maintains something else, you say, well, I'm going to qualify that. And then you qualify again and qualify again until absolutely no religion can be false. Then you've died the death of 1,000 qualifications, and it's vacuous. You're not making any claim. And thus, what I want to say is that by making religion imperious to falsification, you'll do it no favors. Instead of protecting it, you will remove it from the realm of meaning. You will make it meaningless. If it is not subject to the predicates true and false, if it dies the death of 1,000 qualifications, then religion does not amount to anything at all. The kind of religious tolerance, in the name of tolerance, which refuses to pronounce any religion true and others false, leads to the death of religion. And thus, religious pluralism and relativism is no friend of religion. And because anthropology, of course, is dependent upon one's considerations of religious theology, he who says no religion is false is no friend of religion and thereby no friend of man. We must take the position here that all religions are not alike and must not be equally true, that they do stand subject to falsification. And so that leads into what I want to discuss today, and that's the question of plurality. If there are these plural faiths, how can the Christian be sure that he's latched on to the right one? The question arises, if all religions are not true, which one is? At this point, having seen that the idea of concentric circles is muddled and very misleading, we note that upon examination there is, I want to maintain, one basic contrast between the various ideas of God. There's a very fundamental root contrast to all of the religious hypotheses. That contrast is the biblical view of God versus every other idea of God which has been propounded in the history of religions and philosophy. There is a sense in which all religions outside of Christianity do agree. They all agree with one another against Christianity. On two central points in their view of God, the world religions differ with the biblical perspective completely. And hence, biblical Christianity is set off from all other faiths as completely unique when it comes to the question, who and what is God? And I want to schematize that contrast. And I think that if you can remember this diagram and how to apply it, that it might be very helpful to you when you're witnessing to people who come up with this idea of plurality. Because the diagram, unless, of course, you know, the preparation, the study that I've done is somehow short-sighted. I haven't found that to be the case. It's always possible. But I do believe the diagram will apply to every religious faith that has ever been propounded in the history of man. It's because it's so general and basic that I can make such a claim for it. But it looks like the traditional square of opposition in logic, for those of you who have studied that. Now, what this square represents, I'll try to explain briefly. The top line of the square will represent the view of transcendence that is being maintained in the religion. Transcendence. And the bottom line will be the view of immanence that is being maintained in the religion. What is their view of God's transcendence? What is their view of God's immanence? And over here on the left-hand corner, this line is going to represent the Christian view, and this line here, the various non-Christian views. And so, putting it all together, if I'm not going too quickly here, what we have is the Christian view of God's transcendence in this corner, the Christian view of God's immanence in this corner. And then you have the non-Christian view, whatever religious manifestation it takes, the non-Christian view of God's transcendence in this corner, the non-Christian view of God's immanence in this corner. Now let's add a couple of complications to the diagram and we'll be done. It will turn out that the Christian view of God's transcendence will always be exactly, diametrically opposite of the non-Christian's view of God's immanence. What our view of transcendence is going to contradict what every religion says about the nearness of God, about His proximity to man. And, contrariwise, our view of immanence will contradict every non-Christian view of God's transcendence. Am I going too quickly? Does anybody want to go over that much? I only want to add one more thing. You can take one more detail. We're ready. Okay, now the only other thing I want to add is this. That the non-Christian views of transcendence and immanence are also working against one another. They are pulling apart. What the non-Christian says about transcendence violates, contradicts what he says about immanence. But, on the Christian view, what we say about transcendence leads to our view of immanence. Indeed, once we get into the explanation of the example here, I think you'll see that this is exactly what the message of the gospel is. The transcendent God has become immanent. And it's because he's transcendent that he is able to be immanent. Okay, so this is the basic contrast, which I think holds between all religions. The Christian view, let me label that for you, the Christian view is over here, and the non-Christian views are all here. And that's the most basic contrast in the history of philosophy and the history of religious study. All non-Christian religions say this about God's transcendence. Now let's start filling in the diagram. The non-Christian view always reduces to this. God is so far beyond us, so distant, so different, that he cannot clearly, he cannot unambiguously manifest himself or be immediately present to man. God is so far out there. He's so different. He's so transcendent that there's no way you can really know about him. You can't unambiguously know about him. There can be no clear revelation of God. God cannot be apprehended in human thought. So any clear revelation of him is mistaken without question. It's automatically mistaken. Actions and words are always ambiguous and always vague. Hence, God cannot make himself known or reveal himself in history or in the world of words and actions. Okay, so this is the non-Christian view. They always say, God is so different. He's so far beyond us. Nobody can know for sure. But then we come, on the other hand, to the non-Christian view of God's immanence, and it always comes down to this. In some way, God is identified with the world, or an aspect of the world. Transcendent, he is so far beyond the world that nothing in the world can reveal him clearly. But he's immanent in that he is identified with the world. He may be nature, he may be everything altogether, he may be man's reason, he may be the emotion of love, but he's identified with the created order, and therefore the creator-creature distinction is wiped out. It is thought that just in the limitations and the relativities of this world, we are shown God, are pointed to him. And summing this up then, the non-Christian religions assert first that God is unknowable and not in sovereign control of the world. That is, God is too far beyond us to be understood, too far to be clearly known. Fate or chance or a blind law rules over all reality. And then they assert that God is known through something in creation, the movements of nature, the thoughts of the philosophers, the experiences of the mystics. Thus, God cannot unambiguously come into contact with man, and man knows God only by some sort of self-effort. Now, the most important thing to notice here is that the non-Christian religions all have thereby a self-contradictory view of God. On the one hand, God cannot be known, but on the other hand, the non-Christian claims to have knowledge of him. It's Paul's experience in Athens all over again. God is unknowable, but the non-Christian presumes to tell you what he is like. This pattern is common to all non-Christian systems of thought and religions. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that the non-Christian is going to come right out on the surface and make this contradiction clear to you. But what I'm saying is if you study any system of contrary theology, the motif will be found, transcendence and immanence, and they'll be contradictory. This pattern is common to all non-Christian systems of thought and religions, and thus the unbiblical world religions are always denying the Christian God. It's just because of this fundamental contradiction that they must be in opposition to what Christianity claims. They claim that such a God, as the Christians maintain, cannot exist. It is impossible. Indeed, it's an impossible notion. It cannot be thought. The Christian claims they have a clear revelation from God. The non-Christian tells him that God is too transcendent to be unambiguously known. The Christian says that God is different from the world. He's different from historical process. He's different from man's rationality. He's not man's emotion per se. The non-Christian says that God must be found within the world in some way, such as these. But remember the self-contradiction that's always there in the non-Christian's polemic against the Bible. Nobody knows about God, but I know you're wrong. This is as silly, though in certainly a more dreadful way, it's as silly as a person pronouncing that nobody knows what next year's Chevy Malibu will look like, and then turning around and rejecting all hypothetical illustrations that are drawn up. It is just this pattern and just this dilemma that all unbiblical religions exhibit. And I want to illustrate that by quickly running through a survey of comparative religions in some of the time that is left. In each case, you will notice that in some way, God is said to be unknowable, and then nevertheless identified with some aspect of the world. We'll be told that mystery and fate afflict gods, or the God, and afflict the world as well, the cosmos. That God is beyond control of the world. The transcendence of God as unknowable and not in sovereign control of all things is seen in the following common elements of the world religions. And the concepts or the motifs, this, if you are taking notes, and I think some of you are, you may want to get this. These are the motifs you want to look for as an apologist. The of transcendence now for this part of the diagram up here. Motifs of mystery. God being beyond conceptualization. God being beyond description. Irrationalism. Agnosticism. Fate. Magic. The arbitrary positing of some element in the world or some element in the conceptual world above the other. God not being in contact with the world or contact with man. Now, the common motifs of God's immanence in non-Christian religions are summarized in these. There are knowable elements about God. That is, these religions give descriptive detail to their God. And indeed, his will can be known, guiding their lives. Ways of discerning God and his will within man's grasp are enumerated. God is represented in one form or another. An overly intimate connection of God with the world or man. Pantheism is obviously an overly intimate identification of God with the world by making God the world itself. These two positions are contradictory, and thus, as you'll realize as elementary logicians, anything can be deduced from them. If I tell you both P and not P, then you are privileged, according to the common laws of logic, for whatever that's worth, but you are privileged in academic circles anyway to deduce anything. And I want to maintain that just because this is contradictory, you're going to see that just about everything has been deduced. And I have notes extensively on the various religions of the world, but the time element has forced me to pick out just a few. If you have a particular interest in one of the religions of the world, I don't claim to be an expert in all of them by any means, but I'll be glad to share with you what research I have in that particular area if I have not covered today. But I'm going to jump into somewhat late into the development of history, the historical religions of the world, by looking at Zoroastrianism first of all. Zoroastrianism superseded the Iranian Heoma cult, which said that the god of life, Heoma, permeated the entire universe in liquid form. Okay, now the Zoroastrians, what is their view of transcendence? The ultimate singular truth about reality is impossible to know. Zoroaster said, that which is most basic about reality, the ultimate, the one, cannot be known. Ahura Mazda is posited as the wise and kind creator. But this creator is limited in power and authority. He has no physical nature and no contact with the physical world. And so you have a limited God. There is fate above God. Now, that is going to be misleading to some of you. I better point that out. Sometimes when I use the word God here, you must realize that that which functions as the transcendence of the non-Christian's position is not that which he labels God. Because most non-Christian religions have something which is more ultimate than God, usually fate. Sometimes it's time, sometimes it's space, But there's usually an overarching category into which God then fits. And so what I was just saying here may have seemed to you a little bit confusing. Let me go over that again. The ultimate singular truth about reality is impossible to know. That's the transcendence, that ultimate truth, that fate which governs all things. Then Ahura Mazda, that is the creator of the world, who can then have no contact with it, is limited in power and authority underneath that overarching category. So we're told this, but on the other hand, we're told by the Zoroastrians that Ahura Mazda can be represented as a leaping flame. And hence, there's an emphasis in that religion upon sacred fire. There is an ultimate, irreconcilable metaphysical dualism. That is, there are two fundamental realities in incessant struggle with each other. The good creative impulse of Ahura Mazda and his destructive adversary, the negative impulse of Ahriman. Everything that exists is dualistically split. Like the deity of pure will, humans have irrationality, free will within them as well. The analog of this conflict within them, which is their free will. So you'll notice that if you're arguing with the Zoroastrian on the street corners of Jackson someday, that he's going to maintain that you can't know the ultimate truth about religion because that's even beyond Ahura Mazda. But he's going to tell you an awful lot about Ahura Mazda and his adversary and the conflict involved. So nobody knows for sure, but I know that this is the case. Let's look at the Incas now. Their view of transcendence was that the god of the sun cult, Huayacaca, cannot be found out. He cannot be located. He absorbs contradiction into himself. Now a man, now a woman, now above, now below is the chant. The supreme being worshipped by a higher society in the Inca cult is vague and indefinite. He is beyond rational discernment. Now, that isn't the language of the Incas. That's just my summary. You cannot capture God. Sometimes he's above, sometimes he's below. Man, woman, he's all the contradictions. He draws him into himself. And so he's so transcendent that you can't conceptualize him. There's no way to know him. But then the Incas had a view of immanence, too. The reigning Inca turned out to be the incarnate God, God of the sun. Deceased rulers were mummified and worshipped as gods. Everyone participated in the sun cult. Nobody knew, and yet everybody participated. Common people practice ancestor worship and human sacrifice, particularly the sacrifice of children, and the worship of demons was promoted. And so you have this strange contradiction. Nobody knows what the religious situation really is, but we all know we have to sacrifice our children. The Teutonic religion of the Scandinavian Vikings, let's look at them. Their view of transcendence was that the Teutonic gods only stand at the head of a magical world governed by fate. They are closely, tightly within the ring of an immutable order. They're only at the top of it, and fate rules over them. The gods are exalted human forms possessing magical powers, but they are not immortal. They are subject to decay. And so the gods, that is the term god, is subject to what we would say functionally is the god of our system, the ultimate principle of determination in the universe. The gods fear the impending nemesis of fate, an inescapable power whose intentions cannot be divined by them. And so Icelandic sagas are pervaded with a sense of total subjugation of man and the gods to their destiny. But on the other hand, the Teutonic religions have a view of immanence, too. The certain symbols, which are scratched in wood, their runic letters, are tossed like lots, like dice, to magically control the immanent forces about them. And even the gods own their superhuman power to their knowledge of the runic dice. Magic powers were ascribed to Flygiga, the spirit who is charged with power in the individual, and to Laminija, the protective spirit, bringing good fortune.
I'm not going to go into some of the interesting details of what they did in worshiping, their folklore and so forth. If you have read about the Vikings, you probably know about that already. But the point is still this. Even the gods have that transcendence above them, which they can't understand, they can't divine, they can only hope through the magical use of these dice to control their fortune. Well, it's pretty clear in these older religions that you have that motif, but we'll try to get more sophisticated and show you that the motif applies to the history of philosophy and to modern theology as well. And so I'm going to jump into a different vein here, and let's look at Xenophanes, of course, the philosophic predecessor to Parmenides in the history of philosophy. Xenophanes is not technically a philosopher, he's a writer in literature, but he certainly informed Parmenides. Xenophanes' view of transcendence was this: nobody can know the characteristics of God, since God cannot be like anything in creation. So Xenophanes attacked the popular anthropomorphic religions. He said, all these religions are anthropomorphic. They all make God look like man, and therefore it must be false because God is different from man. God's so transcendent, he can't be understood. Then Xenophanes said, but as a philosopher, he is able to tell us what God is. You see, the popular religions, they're all messed up because they're anthropomorphic. But the philosophers who can gaze upon the purity of being and so forth, the one and the many, the eternal principle which encompasses the whole of nature, can be discerned by the philosopher, which is pantheism. He identifies the world of his experience with God. And so nobody knows for sure. The popular religions of his day are false, but as a philosopher, he knows what God is like. Jumping up in the history of philosophy to Stoicism, the Stoics held that man's fate was determined by mechanistic laws governing everything. Fire is the fundamental principle of things. And so they had a pessimistic indifference, which was generated in them. Thus we have the idea of a man behaving as a Stoic, having Stoic endurance. But on the other hand, they had a definite view of God's immanence, too, for they said that man participates in the Logos. And man has the seeds of right knowledge within him. The air around man, they held, was filled with a kind of spiritual fluid. And that penetrated man as he breathed. And so here's the seeds of knowledge, participation in the divine word, or the divine rationale, the divine idea, the Logos. And as man breathes, he has God coming in and out of him. Man shares the divine nature and gains true knowledge by contemplation. As the Stoics were wont to chant, like is known by like. And we can know God because we're like him. Idolatry was felt to express their natural kinship to God. So on the one hand, man's fate determining all things, making everything mysterious, and we must be indifferent to what happens to us. But on the other hand, even idols are tolerated because like can be known by like. Well, even then, that's not really the heyday of Greek philosophy, so let's be fair and go up to who is probably the grandest of the Greek philosophers, Plato, who held in his view of transcendence that God as the world reason, or the nous, or another way you put it, was the form or the idea of the goodness, is correlative to an inexplicable, eternal, chaotic matter over against it. Now, not even God, Plato said, can make a perfect world out of that stuff matter. And so God is limited in power. The good is simply posited as more basic than evil. Plato had no reason to maintain that. He had no reason to prefer the forms of ethereality, ethical virtues, and so forth, to the forms of mud, hair, and filth. He simply posited the good as more basic than evil, and then held that brute fate controlled history, the historical process. But on the other hand, Plato said, in his view of immanence, man is a composite of form and of matter. Man is a composite of reason and irrationality. His matter, which individuates him, and his reason, the form, which gives him knowledge, are together in the same being. To put it more accurately, being and non-being are somehow in the world of becoming together in the form of man. And so knowledge is remembrance based upon a divine pre-existence. When you know things, it's because you were familiar with the form, particularly the form of the good in a previous life. And at death, man would be spliced back into the eternal rational principle, the form of the good, or God. So reason is the source of knowledge of God. And yet Plato had already maintained that God could not be known because he was beyond the world, transcendent. I'm going to skip Aristotle and just deal with Thomas Aquinas, I think, to give you something of a Christianized version of this in Roman Catholic apologetics, because Aquinas was so similar to Aristotle. He held the transcendence of God to be in this form, that there are various mysterious truths of God which must be known by faith if they are known at all. And this faith, by which the mysteries are known, is divorced from natural reason. God does not control history. God is not sovereign in the sense that John Calvin wished to maintain. Therefore, fate, in some sense, determined what would happen to us. God looked upon historical process as man looked upon the historical process, wondering what would happen. And the mysteries of God were transcending man's reason. And yet, on the other hand, he held a view of eminence, didn't he? He said the basic truths can be known by natural reason. Indeed, he has an elaborate natural theology, which shows us that God does exist. And via by means of the via negativa, the method of remotation, he shows what God must not be. We can know that he's not like the creature. So we know that God is, and we know what he's not in terms of his qualities, because man is on the scale of being with God. He is not at the same level on the scale of being, but he's on the same scale of being, and therefore he can use analogy, can use his reason, to work up by self-effort to a knowledge of God. And so on the one hand, you have this transcendence, on the other, this immanence. Well, looking away from Catholicism to deism later on, history of philosophy, the deists held that God was really transcendent, didn't they? God is totally removed from the world and does not cause specific events in the world. He has no immediate relation with the world and has no commerce with it. But on the other hand, man's reason, rationalism, is all-sufficient in understanding. So even though there is no revelation from God about him, man's mind is the source of information about deity. And thus, reason and revelation are harmonized because revelation is collapsed into reason. God cannot be known because he's so far above us, but then my reason is identified in some sense with God because it can, by its own effort, identify God and tell us what he's like. I'll just look at one of the Eastern religions, and I'll expect anybody who wants more information can see me after the lecture. Let's look at Theravada Buddhism as an example of Eastern religions that are rather popular in our day. The Theravadaist holds this view of transcendence. Karma is the law of action and reaction, which is impersonally operating in the universe. Rebirth takes place not personally, but only by force of a person's karma, the consequences of his deeds. And there is no Atman in the body. So rebirth takes place without transmigration, though in practice many Buddhists didn't grasp that fact. The Theravada sense of Buddhism didn't realize that. Nirvana is where karma ends, a condition eliminating any future rebirth and the release from the cravings and the sufferings of the world. So the ultimate reality and the first cause are completely beyond knowledge, beyond fate, beyond the cycle of rebirth. There is no personal God, and a minimal positive content is packed into nirvana, although in popularizations of this, nirvana takes on all sorts of definite form. In the original text of the Theravada Buddhist, of course, nirvana was very much unknown. What lives on after death is simply karma, the result of what happened before. It conditions what happens in the next, if you wish to call it life, although we don't really know that it's life either. Nirvana is an escape, as their phrase was, quote, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea. And it was defined only by the negative approach, like Aquinas, by remotation. And so Buddha declared nirvana was indefinable. But on the other hand, the immanence view, Buddha said that his mission was to show man the way of escape. Through suffering, the way of escape from suffering and karma, not to describe what he would find when he was liberated. That is, I don't know what liberation is, but I know the way to liberation. Buddhism knows, we are told, that all that exists passes through the cycle of birth, growth, decay, and death, that the phenomenal world has a purely relative existence. Separate individual existence is an illusion. Impermanence, lack of objective reality, applies to everything, even to the individual. And though asceticism, through asceticism and a concentrated effort at thinking, mystical enlightenment becomes possible. And so on the one hand, nobody knows, but if you try hard enough, you will be enlightened. You can escape the process. And on the examples could go in this way. Let me give you a couple of examples from modern philosophy and theology, and then I'll get on with my conclusion. Immanuel Kant was a philosopher, of course, and he maintained that God was a noumenal object beyond the categories of reason and understanding, beyond the forms of sensibility. God cannot then enter the phenomenal world in any way. There is no propositional knowledge of him. For there to be propositional knowledge, it would have to be rationally discursive, but God, by definition, is beyond rational discursive thought, and therefore God cannot be clearly understood. Any evidence for God in the phenomenal world must, by its very nature, Kant said, be ambiguous. All phenomena are chance events. But on the other hand, he held to a view of God's immanence. Not just that God cannot be known, but he says that God does feed raw data into man's mental apparatus. He comes out looking like any finite. When God does feed this raw data about himself into our minds, God comes out looking like any finite, relativized object. We can speak of his absoluteness, then, only in the realm of practical morality, where God is found in man's ethical consciousness, an experience of right and wrong. God's then postulated as the ultimate validator of ethics. We must act as though there were a God, as though there were a day of judgment. And conscience is considered as God's command. When my conscience can meet the categorical imperative of reason, then I found what God would command me to do. And I must consider, even though it's only a limiting concept, I must consider that I shall be judged on the day of judgment, which I can't understand, which there mustn't be, but I must think that there is a day of judgment to motivate me in my ethical life. And so God's absoluteness is in us, then, as ethical creatures, not transcendent in his own being. And for obvious reasons, I'm going to move immediately from Immanuel Kant to Karl Barth in modern theology. God is transcendent, as wholly other from man. There can be no direct revelation of God in history, no clear, no unambiguous revelation is possible. And yet, God does reveal himself completely to us, Barth says, by becoming one with us in Geschichte, the Christ event. Hence, God is completely hidden and God is totally revealed. He turns into the opposite of himself to bring all men into his own being. At one point, he is wholly other and cannot be known. At the other, he is totally identified with man, transcendent and immanent in his contradictory way. Now, process theology and, say, Charles Hartshorne or Hubert Ogden, John Cobb, hold that God is transcendent in that he is not separate from creation, or he is not in total control of everything that happens. This is panentheism. Everything is in God. He's part of the process that is developing history. But fate still stands above God, and he must adapt and respond to fate. God must interact with the world and must interact to the processes that are controlling him. And so everything is in process, including God. But on the other hand, we can come to know God by reasoning up to him by means of analogy, we are told. When we look at the natural world, we see the relativities of the natural world, we can move from those relativities to what God must be by analogy. And so God comes out definitely looking like man and looking like the creation indeed. The only revelation we could have of this non-omnipotent God must come from our experience, Cobb says, our experience of change, reaction, and adaptation in the world, our experience of process. Well, let me end the illustrations there. I was hoping to demonstrate thereby that whether you begin in the most ancient religions of mankind and the sophistication of Greek philosophy, the history of philosophy, the Eastern religions, or modern theology, you'll find the same transcendent immanence dialectic. But in direct contrast to this self-contradictory notion of God in all the non-Christian or unbiblical religions of the world stands the biblical revelation about God. According to it, God's transcendence means that in everything, God remains the sovereign Lord. In which case, because God is sovereign Lord over all things, he cannot be identified with creation or history. Rather, he is the creator Lord above them. And so you see why I said that the Christian view of transcendence is just the opposite of the non-Christian view of immanence. The non-Christian says that in some way, God must be identified with the world, whether he be nature, as with the pantheist, or whether he be reason with the deist, or whatever. In some way, God is part of the natural world. But the Christian says, no, he is the sovereign Lord. That's what transcendence means. And therefore, he cannot be identified with historical process. He cannot be identified with the created world. He cannot be identified with man's reason. And that's in direct opposition to the non-Christian religions, which draw God down into the world, or down into history in various ways. The Bible clearly declares that God is the creator, and therefore nothing in the world can be identified with him. Paul says, by him were all things created, which are in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. And indeed, everywhere he is God without competition. Jehovah, he is God in heaven above and upon earth beneath. There is none else. Deuteronomy 4:39. Consequently, since he is Lord above creation, the creation cannot contain him, and our minds cannot encompass him. Behold, heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain thee, 1 Kings 8:27. Thus saith Jehovah, heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. What manner of house will you build unto me, and what place shall be my rest? For all things hath my hand made. Isaiah 66:1. Paul declares the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. For who hath known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor? God is transcendent, the sovereign Lord above creation. He is the sovereign Lord over history, and therefore he controls history, and no fate obstructs his decrees, no fate thwarts his plan. I am God, and there is none else like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Yea, I have spoken it, and I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it, I will also do it. Isaiah 46, very common passage to you, I'm sure. He doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say, what doest thou? You must grasp the lordship, the sovereignty of God. That's his transcendence. In no way can he be the historical prophet, in no way can he be the natural world, precisely because he's the Lord over both. But on the other hand, the Christian biblical view of God's eminence is this. God is sovereignly present to man. You see, because he is sovereign, he can become present to man. Because God created and controls all things, he can come right into our lives, right into our world, right into our history, right into our hearts. And thus, God can reveal himself in history and the world. That's just the opposite of what the non-Christian says about transcendence. No way can there be a clear revelation of God. We say, yes, he can make himself imminently known in the Bible, in his Son, in our hearts through the Spirit. He is known because he is sovereign. It's because he's sovereign that he can give a clear revelation of himself. Because he is sovereign, he can become incarnate. But that's just the opposite of what the unbeliever wants to say. Man, according to Scripture, was created and redeemed precisely for fellowship, for nearness with God. And thus the biblical concept of God's eminence is the very opposite of the non-Christian views of God's transcendence, which says that God cannot make himself clearly known, cannot come into unambiguous contact with the world. Scripture tells us definitely that God is very near to us. Am I a God at hand, saith Jehovah, and not a God afar off? Can any hide himself in secret places so that I shall not see him, saith Jehovah? Do not I fill heaven and earth, saith Jehovah. Jeremiah 23:23. Whither shall I go from thy spirit, or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. And if I make my bed in Sheol, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell on the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. There was a definite strength of David, a eminence, the nearness of God to him, Psalm 139. As Paul says in Acts 17 to the philosophers, he is not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our existence. Because God is sovereignly present to man, it is possible for the psalmist to speak of being close to God. We can be close to God because God draws close to us. Thou shalt guide me with thy counsel and afterwards receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but thee, and there is none upon earth that I desire besides thee. My flesh and my heart faileth, but God is the strength of my heart, and my portion forever. For lo, they that are far from thee shall perish. Thou hast destroyed all them that go a-whoring from thee, but it is good for me to draw near to God. I have put my trust in the Lord God, that I may declare all thy works. Psalm 73. Hence, in contrast to the self-contradictory view of God's transcendence and eminence in unbiblical religions, the Christian view of God's transcendence and eminence go hand in hand. God is so transcendent in power, so transcendent in authority, that he can become clearly eminent to man. The sovereign Creator Lord can reveal himself clearly in creation and in history. Nothing can prevent him from coming right into our cosmos, right into our history, right into our hearts. And so you can see that the Christian view of God's transcendence leads right into the view of God's eminence, rather than contradicting it. Because God is Lord and Creator, he can accomplish what he wills to do. And he has willed to reveal himself. He has willed to send his Son. He has willed to put his Spirit in our hearts. The biblical conception of God's eminence never distracts from his transcendence, Rather, God's eminence always complements and emphasizes it. If you think of Genesis 28:15 or Exodus 33:14, Deuteronomy 21, you can see that the two brought together in that way. But just think of the Great Commission. Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age, and therefore disciple the nations. It's just because he is eminent that he can control the history of the world. God's eminence never distracts from his transcendence. It always emphasizes and complements it. And so the transcendence of God leads to the eminence of God rather than being contradictory, as in the non-Christian religion. And so while the non-Christian religions contradict themselves by pronouncing nobody knows for sure, the Christian is privileged by God's grace, of course, to have a definite and infallible knowledge and truth about God, since God has made himself first known in the revealed words of Scripture to man. Thus, we can know about the living and the true God. How different that is from all the non-Christian religions, where God cannot speak, where he cannot come into contact with man. There is always an inherent difficulty in knowing God. But if there is an inherent difficulty in knowing God, there is an inherent difficulty in arguing with the Christian religion. But this response is possible from the unbeliever. How can you know for sure? Maybe my faith does have this contradictory motif. Maybe yours doesn't. But that's barren, that's formal, that's logical. How can you know that your God really has revealed himself? If your faith were true, as you say it is, how come not everybody affirms it? Well, you can take various approaches to that. You might point out to them that they may not be satisfied even if 73% of all Americans believed in the Christian faith. And if they weren't satisfied with such a statistic, they'd be exactly right, because it's not based on human opinion that you come to your decisions. It's based upon God's revelation. But then the believer says, God's so transcendent you can't know his revelation. The Christian says, but don't you see, that's just what we're talking about. In terms of the Christian faith, the transcendence of God means he can reveal himself. Your faith is of such a nature that it has no adequate reply. That is, the ground is pulled out from under the unbeliever's approach to the Christian faith, whereas the Christian show that in terms of his own suppositions, his own presuppositions, revelation is natural, revelation is to be expected. But how do you explain how everybody misses the point? Why is it that all these other contradictory religions have arisen? The answer, I think, is given by Paul in the first chapter of Romans, where he describes the very process of the unbeliever, who first of all denies the immanence of God. God cannot be known, not clearly. He denies the Christian form of immanence, saying that God is transcendent. And then he proceeds from that very point, Paul says, to construct an image in his own likeness, and then calls it God. He suppresses the clear truth of God, that eminent revelation that comes to him, in order that he might build his own idol. And so all non-Christians do the same thing to get the heat off, to build the roof over their heads against the revelation of God. They do not see the truth because they are suppressing the clear revelation, and then have to construct a functionally equivalent theology to take its place. They have a theology of transcendence. They have a theology of eminence. But it's as destructive of their logic as it is destructive of their spiritual well-being. So that's the explanation that I would give in closing, is the fact that all men have not readily acknowledged the truth of Scripture. There is a subjective problem which prevents them from doing so. The wise observation of Noah Porter might be remembered here. He was an early president of Yale University. He said, remember that what you believe will depend very much upon what you are. What you are will determine what you believe. And if you are guilty before God, then you might have to look at that fact as explaining your reluctance to affirm the God of the Bible. It is only by the sovereign grace of God that we can find peace with God, clarity of understanding. And that's the desire of God, who created us for his fellowship and for our knowledge of him. And that's why the non-Christian religions of all varieties want to deny that the teaching of Scripture can be a clear word from God, they don't have a leg to stand on. Because the non-Christian says nobody knows, he only refutes himself by daring to pronounce Christianity false. These are the lengths to which the non-Christian must go to build his idols, to suppress the clear revelation of God. However, God has clearly revealed himself, so that man may have assurance and may have truth. The biblical portrayal of God is both consistent and compelling. And so what we find is that while we have begun our lecture in search of God, in truth it is that God has come in search of us.
Thank you.